order today, but I don't think it will burden anybody out there. We'll start with Senate Bill 156, public hearing. And if you want to come on up while I'm going off the rest of the agenda here, that would be great. After that, we'll do the work session on Senate Bill 99, which will go very quickly, both of these first two. And then we'll do the public hearing and probable work session on Senate Bill 240, and then we'll finish up with Senate Bill 134. Senator Bates is excused. He had an illness, I don't think too serious, but enough of a concern with his spouse that he drove home today, so he won't be with us. But I'll open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 156. Ms. Shibley, if you want to get us started.
You bet. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm delighted to be here. For the record, my name is Gail Shibley. I'm the administrator of the Public Health Division's Office of Environmental Public Health in the Department of Human Services. We are here in support of Senate Bill 156. It is one part of a three-part solution to a three-part problem that we have in the state of Oregon in terms of assuring safe, clean, reliably, safe, clean drinking water statewide. Some of you know, and I will only give the three-hour version right now instead of the six-hour version, but some of you are only too familiar with some of the capacity needs that we have, state and county public health, to assure safe drinking water. We are concerned about the quality of the water and possible contamination of the water sourced to tap, and so our focus and oversight and safety protection efforts are focused sourced to tap. Along those lines, we have the three parts problem that we're facing is underperformance because of lack of capacity for current federal health standards. Second part is the variety of new standards that are coming. And the third are the, we don't know how many, maybe about 1,000 smaller systems that are not subject to the federal standards but that are written into ORS 448 and which we have zero capacity to assist. So as a consequence, we are continuing to move toward this three-part solution. One is a $2.4 million additional general fund that is in the governor's recommended budget. The second is a bill that's over in the House Bill 2187, that will authorize public health to recover the cost of performing an on-site inspection. And the third is Senate Bill 156. Nice. Senate Bill 156 provides, for the first time in the history of the state of Oregon, a statutorily authorized, recognized, and constituted advisory committee to assure that we in public health have advice and assistance in assuring safe drinking water. Many of the, from lines 10 through 24 of the bill, many of those entities currently are represented on what we constituted administratively as a drinking water advisory committee that's been going now for several years. Terrific group of people, hardworking, extremely helpful, could not do our job nearly as well without them. And the gentleman sitting next to me, who's a member of that committee, will say, that work and that committee deserves elected policymaker attention, focus, and the inclusion of all appropriate and interested parties. And so we commend to you this bill. We have the support of several folks who are here in the room who have indicated that they'll save you all some time in not testifying today, but I'm sure we'll be happy to voice their support from the League of Cities, from special districts, from backflow testers. And I'd like to ask Mr. Kurtz if he'd like to say a couple words in support of this bill as well.
Yeah, certainly. Mr. Kurtz, go ahead and just give us your name and then go right ahead.
Hi, Senator Vakian and fellow committee members. I'm Michael Kurtz. Thank you for the opportunity for allowing me to come today in support of this bill. I've served on the Drinking Water Advisory Committee since 1989, I believe. The advisory committee has been in existence since 1981, as I know it. And it has representation from water supply industry throughout the state of Oregon. This bill will strengthen that representation by broadening it and putting in more groups on the committee. It will put it in statute so that right now it's a voluntary committee. Basically, the administrator set it up. A previous administrator has been maintained by the administration for the drinking water program. But without the statute, that could go away. I believe that it could, its future existence could depend on the whims of a future administrator decisions not to have it. So I support it. I ask for your support. It deserves support. And I would like to say one of the most significant accomplishments we've done while we've been on that committee is provide guidance to the state for the use of the state revolving fund money that comes from the federal government. And this is a fund that has divvied out more than $100 million since 1997, mostly to small water systems who really need it and depend on that money to improve their system. So it has, I believe our help in providing policy direction was needed and should be continued. Thank you.
Very good. Questions? Senator Beyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I guess I'll start by saying you haven't convinced me yet. You need to be in statute. But if you do convince me, I'd like to know in your list of people who should be on the committee why you would choose a nominee from a watershed council and not talk with people from the soil water conservation districts. Soil water conservation districts are at least a locally elected representatives, not people who are appointed by other interested people. So I guess that's the question I'd like to have answered.
Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, I appreciate the question. We kind of tussled a little bit about exactly how best to identify specifically in statute who, as the language on line 7 and 8 say, that or 8 and 9 rather, the officer shall make the appointments after considering nominations from. One of the reasons why watershed councils was determined to be a logical stakeholder was because, as I said, we are liable for and we are required to provide protection and assure health standards sourced to tap. And so we wanted to partner with groups and organizations that have source to tap somewhere along that line, expertise, interest, commitment, and can provide the kind of advice that Mr. Kurtz mentioned. I could not tell you that what all the groups were that we considered, and so if there's, whether it's the one you mentioned or any other one, I'd be happy to talk with you about that and explore that. Could well be that's a viable addition. I don't have anything necessarily against that. I wanted to answer the first half of your question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd just like to, I guess it says 15-member committee, and I did recognize that it says the appointments shall be made after considering nominees from, but then you went on to list 15 groups that you would consider nominees from. So that is implied that if it's a 15-member committee and these 15 groups get to nominate someone, the appointment is going to come from that. And I would go back to, if you're looking from someone who has expertise or responsibility of source to tap, at least soil water conservation district directors are elected local officials. Watershed council members are just that. They're people who may or may not, you know, just get appointed because I don't even know what the qualifications are for a watershed council member, but at least a soil and water conservation district director has had to put their name on a ballot and been elected, and they are responsible for that same. They're countywide normally, but they're responsible for the watersheds in their county or in their district.
Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, I know you've seen, again, on line 21, the Special Districts Association of Oregon, that may not take care of the specific concern that you're raising, but I want to just, use that, if you will, to demonstrate that we're, you know, that was precisely the attempt to look at all different types of systems. You know, Mr. Kurtz is here just, you know, east of the Capitol in a special district, I want to say, soil and water district.
It's a domestic water system under ORS 264.
But we have, out of the 3,600 and some public community water systems in the state, we've got a wide variety. And so the intent here is to make sure that we have a good, solid, complete representation on this committee.
Anything further, committee?
All right. One quick question.
Senator Atkinson.
I'm struggling to know why we need the committee. Why can't you do this on your own?
Well, Mr. Chair, Senator Atkinson, I appreciate that, and trust me, as a bureaucrat, why would I take on the additional strings, if you will, related to an official advisory committee, a statutory advisory committee? Let me tell you that that among other things, there are a couple reasons why I was convinced that it was appropriate, and I don't want to disregard what Mr. Kurtz said as well, that we thought it up, we can unthink it at any time, and it can go away, and we can decide how to spend what's now $130 million in low interest loans all over the state. If you're fine with that, then you know we'll do it as we see fit. We wanted to engage the legislature as elected policymakers to discuss, debate, and otherwise get engaged with how critically important assuring the safety of clean drinking water is sourced to tap around the state. Right now we have huge disparities between the very big systems and the thousands, literally, of smaller systems, and we need to make sure that we're doing justice to all the systems statewide. The second piece is that as I represent environmental public health, we have in statute, and I'm sorry I couldn't quote the ORSs to you, a food service advisory committee in statute. We have in statute a radiation advisory committee. We have in statute, probably three or four other public health advisory committees, very specific. Frankly, I just feel, and I was persuaded by folks within the advisory committee as well as in the program, that drinking water is at least as fundamental as radiation protection, as food, as many of the other EMS, the State Trauma Advisory Board, and on and on. And we feel like it deserves its place at the table as well.
Mr. Chair, I'm just a little skeptical. I've been around so actually doing this particular committee for so long that we've seen committees get started and then new committees get formed and then cleanup language and then the politics of fluoride bills and yada yada yada. It just to me sounds,
because you don't have a fluoride, but you don't have a fluoride bill today, do you, in your back pocket somewhere?
Mr. Chair, I am plumb out of any fluoride.
Let's do this. We've got a little bit more work to do. This bill will come back before this committee, but we've got a little more work to do on it. And so we'll end the public hearing now, but you spend a little time in the next week or so, and then we'll be back, okay? All right.
Point taken.
Thank you, Mr. Kurtz, for being here today. Appreciate your testimony. And I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 156, open up a work session on Senate Bill 99. And Ms. Marshall, if you don't mind, just it's only been a week, but give us a quick rundown on what the bill was and what was done that leads us to the work session.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, this measure revises the Forest Land Urban Interface Fire Protection Program, allows the state forester to enter into cooperative agreements with local governing bodies or homeowners associations. It modifies the state forester's ability to designate and classify forest land urban interface lands, reduces quorum requirements for county classification committees, and defines members' term limits and modifies obligation of landowner to minimize fire hazard. There was a concern raised by David Moskowitz of Confluence Consulting related to possible conflict with existing resource protection laws. There was a dialogue between Mr. Moskowitz and Mr. Gibson and Mr. Moskowitz no longer has the concern, as it appears that that language already exists in Section 19.
Okay.
So.
So at this point, it appears any misgivings about the bill were worked out or the discussion occurred. There doesn't seem to be any opposition to the bill at this point, nor was there in the committee last time. So I scheduled the work session. But committee, is there any discussion amongst ourselves? This was the one, if you remember, Senator Bates has his place in Sun River, and he was, of course, very interested in. Yeah, Senator Beyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I asked for a list of the counties, and as they were progressing, I appreciate that list has been provided. And I guess I'd just be interested in asking the Forestry Department or whoever is, you know, in charge of implementing this, what the timeline is for the rest of the counties and how counties are chosen to get on this list as far as currently being implemented, and there are five that funding has been secured for. But in my mind, some of the counties that have the worst interface problem aren't even on the list, and I was kind of curious to know, you know, kind of the timeline on those or what.
Yeah, why don't you come on up and answer the put your name on the record, of course, and answer the one question.
Yes, my name is Bill Lafferty. I'm Fire Program Director for Oregon Department of Forestry, and I don't have the list of the counties that was provided to you.
Okay, we have.
Well, and the question, it sounded like, was one more of process as well, is how do counties get on the list? And I'm guessing implicitly, Senator Beyer, in the future, how do counties get on that aren't on now?
Well, yeah, I guess what's the timeline for getting the rest of them done?
It's funding limited and interest limited, and at this moment in time, the ability to do this has been predicated on acquiring federal grants, and we've acquired enough to do what we've done to this point. And so what we've done is strategically looked around the rest of the state in our priority thinking and try to apply the limited funds. So we continue to try to secure federal grants to implement and move into new counties and do that. And so if I'd look at this list where we think we want to go next, Lane County is on our list, and they have an interest to move out as funding becomes available, and so they'd probably be the next one on the list. If we can secure funds, we would go there. Clackamas County is another one. If the county commission is interested, we would be interested, and then we'd figure out how to implement.
I'm glad you mentioned Clackamas County, because that's obviously, you know, that I'm familiar with that one, and that's the county with the largest number of minimum lots by far of any other than the state. That's a very large urban-rural interface. And I was surprised not to see it on the list, because I do know the county commissioners in Clackamas County have implemented a program of their own of hazard abatement. I just assumed it was part of this program. So has there been any dialogue, I guess, with the Clackamas County commissioners and what they're doing currently and how it fits in with the program that we have at the state?
We've been working with the county in development of the countywide Community Wildfire Protection Plan. I haven't been directly involved, but the concept of eventually applying Senate Bill 360 has been on the table. And so as they roll out their plan, the hope is many of those standards get employed by education without imposition of the standards. And that's an option that would be out there for anybody to go ahead and understand similar standards and get them applied without formal adoption.
I see. Great, thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. Committee, any further discussion?
Thank you.
Senator Pozanski, could you give me a motion on Senate Bill 99?
Chair, I'd move Senate Bill 99 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Pozanski moves Senate Bill 99 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Are there any objections? Seeing none, Senate Bill 99 passes to the floor with the due pass recommendation. We'll have Senator Bates carry the bill. And I close the work session on Senate Bill 99. I do that, of course, not picking on anybody who's out of town with a sick spouse, but only because of his interest in protecting his Sun River cabin.
We'd do it because we love
him. And because he wasn't here for any reason, I suppose. All right. I open a public hearing on Senate Bill 240. There we go. Yeah, thanks. Senator Cruz, I imagine you'll want to say something about this, if you don't mind coming up first.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Senator Jeff Cruz, Senate District 1. And thank you for the opportunity to testify on this bill.
Actually, Senator Cruz, let me interrupt for just a second. I'm going to have Ms. Marshall just give a quick summary of the bill.
Good idea. And then
we'll,
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 240 extends a program that provides landowner preference tags to address damage caused by elk on privately owned land in southern Oregon until June 30th, 2014.
Very good. Thank you, Senator Cruz.
Okay. Thank you. I want, once again, for the record, Senator Jeff Cruz, Senate District 1. And this is a continuation of some work that was begun in the year 2001, approximately, simply because the department has a variety of programs that deal with big game animal damage. And none of the programs really worked in Southern Oregon because we have a different land ownership patterns in our part of the state. It's basically a checkerboard. And so ODF&W, along with landowners and a wide variety of folks, got together and developed this. We passed legislation in 2003 to implement this program. I think this is a very good example of an agency being willing to tailor programs and that will be effective specifically for certain regions of the state. I know there's a lot of folks here to testify on it. The big problem at this point in time, the program's been in place for 2 years. It is showing some positive results. Unfortunately, the timeline we put on it in the legislation has the program sunset before the next legislature can meet. And so we just need to extend that so the program can continue. There's a whole lot of really good folks that are here, and I want to especially thank Steve Denny from ODF&W, the Roseburg office, who has been an absolute jewel as an asset for me and on many, many issues, and is a shining light, I think, in ODF&W for the way they work with local folks. So I'll let everybody else who's been more involved in this than I have been, but this should be a relatively simple thing just to extend this. As I remember, in 2003, there was really no opposition by the time we took it to both floors. So thank you very
much. Thank you, Senator. Mr. Zelliker and Denny, why don't you come up next?
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Roy Elliker. I'm Deputy Director for the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife, Deputy Director for Fish and Wildlife Programs. On my right, Mr. Steve Denny. And the agency very much appreciates the very kind words of Senator Cruz on this bill and the relationship we have with landowners in Southern Oregon, and particularly the work of Mr. Denny as our Southwest Region Manager. We do have a number of landowners here to testify, so if I could just quickly, really quickly, go over some of the testimony, and then we'll get out of the way and let you talk directly to landowners who are making this work on their land. Essentially, as Senator Cruz said, it extends the sunset date from 2008 to 2014. That would give us an additional 6 or 7 years of evaluating whether or not this program is working to reduce damage on these private land holdings. And in the meantime, as well, there's possibility that the department might want to extend this statewide or have other options at that time. But again, we felt with only 2 years of full data to evaluate before we had to come back during this session, we felt the wisest course would be to ask for a sunset extension of the pilot program. Purpose of the original bill is to address increasing elk damage to timber and ag lands in southwestern Oregon, where unique pattern of ownership limits the effectiveness of existing landowner programs. On the bottom of page one, we talk about some of the differences between our statewide landowner preference program and this one. And we have a backgrounder as an attachment. I wanted Mr. Denny just to briefly go through this with you, particularly as to the maps we have attached, to show you kind of what we're doing different here in Southern Oregon. Steve.
Thank you, Vice Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Steve Denny, Southwest Region Manager for ODF&W out of Roseburg. And as mentioned, we had a situation occurring where we had increasing elk damage on private lands, and we tried to take a proactive approach to try to address those issues for a couple reasons. One, the unique land pattern that's been mentioned before. Also, we have a very proactive landowners and hunting groups that we were able to work with in coming up with this program. Part of the program was to form an advisory group to help us through the session. Since it was a pilot program, we wanted to identify any issues that would come up during it, some possible solutions. At the bottom of the second page, you can see a list of those of that advisory group. We have a combination of hunters, timber and ag owners, as well as Oregon State Police involved on the advisory committee. When we broached the subject with the issue of this particular bill sunsetting after this session, there was unanimous agreement to extend it so that we could really evaluate the program and make sure it does really reduce elk damage, which is the focus of it. A couple of the particulars of how it does differ from our original LOP program is it does redefines damage so that we can take some proactive approach to damage where we have it historically. It eliminates the minimum acreage size that's in the existing program so that we can deal with those acreages under 40 acres. It doesn't have a deadline. It's kind of a negotiation between our biologists and the landowners on how long these particular tags are available. And then there's no limit on the number of tags due to acreage. It's basically deals with how much damage they're receiving over time. The maps on the second and third pages kind of show some typical examples in our area where we've got shoestring valleys or private ownerships nestled in amongst timberlands. And in both those situations, we've got multiple landowners outlined in black. One is the Sitcom area over in Coos Bay. The other one is Ash Valley on the South Fork of the Umpqua in Douglas County. But we have multiple landowners, some of these with acreages smaller than 40 acres. They've got significant elk damage, and by applying these different types of hunting through the LOP program, we can move elk out of those pastures and onto lands, both federal timber lands or lands that are accessible to the public, and reduce that damage and even make the elk more accessible to the public. So we believe it's a great program. The landowners seem to be very enthusiastic about it, but we need a little bit more time to really tell whether it's going to reduce damage or not. And with that, I'd answer any questions.
Very good. Committee? Nothing? Okay. Gents, thanks very much.
Thank you.
And how about we bring up Ken and David Meserly together? Thanks for joining us.
And thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. I'm Ken Meserly. I have served on the advisory committee for the Fish and Wildlife Department. I'm also a timber part owner of Blanco Incorporated, which is a timber company. I'll be very brief. I simply wanted to say that this program is working very well. It's a simple program that was set up and is doing what it was intended. It is driving, putting pressure on the elk to get them off of the land where they are doing damage. And our experience on our timberlands is that they have done a tremendous amount of damage on our reprod property. And by this program, we're able to, not only ourselves, but people who we know and trust to be on our lands are able to come in and really put the pressure on to move the elk on. So it's a great program. I hope you'll consider doing away with the sunset, or at least extending the sunset. Thank you.
Chairman Abaki and committee members, I'm Dave Meserly. I'm representing Meserly and Sons, a family-held ranching and timberland company that's located in Coos County. Our lands are primarily on the Coos and Coquille River drainage is down fairly low. And as the map indicated that Mr. Denny showed you, we are one of those places where we finger into the valleys that the government and industrial timberlands own behind us. I speak in support of the program. It has been a great tool for us to keep pressure on the elk so they keep moving and they don't congregate, and still allows us to harvest animals from time to time. We appreciate the cooperation of the Department of Fish and Wildlife in this matter. They're real easy to work with, and so I urge you to reenact the bill.
Okay. Very good. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Kent Weigel. Mr. Weigel, thanks very much for being here. Go ahead and just state your name and go right ahead.
Thank you. My name is Kent Weigel. I am a past educator, football coach in Southern Oregon. I hunt on Dave's property, have since the year of 92. Grew up in Southern Oregon and aware as a hunter, grew up with that in a background. And I've had an LOP tag since 1996, I believe, about 10 years. And I experienced the fact that you go on the properties and you go into a field that's had 50 elk in that property the night before, and it's a small property that is used to run cattle on. And when you have that many animals in a field, it's amazing the amount of damage that is done and what happens to fences and the pastures. And I think it's a very good tool. It's better than the past program because the landowner can select people that are hunting on his property, and he can feel comfortable with those people and know the ability that they have as a hunter, and just leads confidence to it. So I'm a supporter of this. Any questions?
Now, you come here to talk to us about the elk issue, but you lead with this thing that you're a coach down in Southern Oregon. So it just makes me curious where you coach.
I'm the football coach at Marshfield High School.
Yeah.
This actually has allowed me to enjoy hunting more because elk season is during the season in the fall when I would be working, and the LOP tag now is in January and February, so I have an opportunity to have a recreation that I do enjoy a lot. It's also an opportunity for me to spend time with young people that we do get tags, and I know Dave has nephews, and so we're getting young people to learn to enjoy and experience the hunting.
That's good. You got a pretty good football team too, don't you?
From time to time, we do. We would always like to win one more.
That's good. All right. Thanks, Mr. Weigel. Mark Wall.
Mr. Chair, committee, thanks for letting me be here today to speak. My name's Mark Wall. I'm a forest land manager for Rosebud Forest Products, based out of Coos Bay. I've been managing timberlands on the coast for 19 years now. I've been involved in this program since its inception. I'm here speaking in support of it. It has worked out very well for us, developing a relationship with our local biologist, in my case, Stuart Love. We get out, we assess the damage. I get his input as far as what he thinks we need to do to the herds. The specific problem I have is large, low-elevation ownerships that are easement through private landowners, so the land is not open to the public. As a result, in the absence of this hunt, I have large herds, anywhere from 40 to 60 animals that we're developing, and basically just using our property as winter range. And in the absence of any harassment or hunting, they were just congregating and really causing us some problems. This program has given us the ability to identify those problem areas and those problem herds, and through the flexibility to issue tags and stagger the hunters, you can apply pressure from basically December 1 through March. There's hunters on certain tracks every weekend, and it really keeps the herd broken up and dispersed, and we are slowly but surely starting to see a reduction in the damage. The proof to me is the hunter's success is actually starting to go down because they're just not finding the elk like they used to 2 years ago when we first started in on this hunt. So that's a good measure of success from my standpoint. Any questions?
Very good. Nothing? No. Thanks very much for coming. Especially, you drove all the way from Coos Bay, didn't you?
Yes.
Yeah. Thanks very much for being here. Mike Deitzel, why don't you come on up? Nice to see you again, Mike.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, for the record, Mike Deitzel, Director of Forest Protection for the Oregon Forest Industries Council here in Salem. We talked earlier on 99 dealing with fire issues. Well, forest protection also encompasses, as you've heard, animal damages, the other side of the hat that I wear. I can't improve on any of the information, success stories, or information that's been provided by people that actually work the land. I just kind of ride a desk anymore in my current career. But on behalf of our members that couldn't come today, I just want to let you know that those same logics are also apparent in the level of support for Roseburg Forest Products, as you heard from Mark, Menasha Forest Products, Plum Creek Timber Company, Lone Rock Timber Company, Seneca Jones Timber Company, of which you should have some written testimony from Manager Bill Moore in their Roseburg office before you, Forest Capital Partners, and also Weyerhaeuser Company. So it's a long list of large landowners that all are very much in support of extending the sunset. So I'll be glad to answer any questions.
All right. Thanks for passing that on. And I don't see any. Mr. Dykes, thanks very much. Jim Welsh.
Chair Vakian, committee members, I'm Jim Welsh here. Just to, for the Oregon Cattlemen Association, we were requested to let you guys know where we came in on this, and we do have some members down in the counties. I've been on a particular ranch down there in Douglas County, have seen the damage from the elk in the 90s even, and we're pleased there's a program like this that will give us a chance to collect some data and see if this program is working. We think it is. We have no problem with this bill, and real quick and short, just give you a thumbs up and move this on. Thank you.
Perfect. Thanks, Mr. Welsh. Going to, is there anybody here that is left to testify on this bill? No? Then I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 240 and open a work session on Senate Bill 240. If I could have a motion.
Mr. Chair, I would move Senate Bill 240 to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Thank you, Senator Atkinson, moving Senate Bill 240 with the due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? And are there any objections? Seeing none, Senate Bill 240 passes to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Senator Beyer, would you carry the bill?
Sure.
And I must say, too, I just appreciate all the folks who came to testify. I know some of you came an awful long way. It's a testament to how successful the program has been, not just to protect property, but to help manage these herds in a reasonable way. So your testimony was valuable. Thank you very much for it. And we'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 134. Ms. Marshall, if you could give us a rundown of the bill.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 134 authorizes the Oregon Veterinary Medical Examining Board to inspect certain premises and order examinations during the course of an investigation of an applicant or licensee.
And Dr. DeBess, you can, you signed up to testify. Come on up if you would like. It is underneath. Sorry, Lori Mackman. Is that right?
Yes.
Mackman?
Mackman.
And is Glenn Kolb here? If you don't mind, you can come right up too. We'll just do both of you. But Ms. Mackman, please go ahead and just state your name and go ahead.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members. For the record, I'm Lori Mackman, Director of the Veterinary Examining Board. The two authorities that we're asking for in this bill, we feel are statutory loopholes that need to be filled to give us the ability to enforce the rules that we already have on the books. couple of sessions ago, OVMA presented Senate Bill 318, which gave the board the authority to direct a licensee or applicant to undergo a physical or mental competency exam if the board felt that there was a need or if there was a potential threat to public or animal safety. That passed handily. Unfortunately, subsequently, we learned that we didn't have the authority to direct the licensee to undergo the examination initially. Senate Bill 318 gave us the authority to discipline a licensee for refusing to undergo the exam. We don't actually have the authority to direct the licensee to undergo the exam, and that's what we're asking for as part of 134. Also, in the last couple of years, the board had an ad hoc committee, the Minimum Standards Committee, and in the course of their work, revising the minimum standards for veterinary practices, they discovered that the board also does not appear to have statutory authority to allow an investigator to enter and inspect a veterinary facility. The board feels that if we don't have this authority, we might as well get rid of 875.015.0020, which lists the minimum standards for veterinary practices, which are listed on in the second paragraph of the handout I gave you. We did have a meeting with OVMA on Sunday, and in addressing their concerns, which we feel are completely valid, we are suggesting a change in the language, which is on the second page. The change merely clarifies that this authority is to be used only in the context of a valid complaint or concern.
Before Mr. Cole testifies, are there any questions? Well, while folks are thinking, could you elaborate a little bit on what the definition of concern would be?
A concern would be a complaint that the board receives either from the public, from a client, from another veterinarian, or a little birdie in the ear that there is a non-compliant condition in a facility, such as I've written, maybe the air quality is bad. Water is not potable. More importantly, isolation of animals with communicable diseases needs to be isolation areas. And we did have in the last 2 years a situation where a clinic was pretty badly non-compliant, and we were able to work with the veterinarian to fix the non-compliant conditions. We didn't really have the authority to do that, but nobody really knew that at the time.
Well, what I'm getting at is you that you use the phrase complaint or concern, the or being disjunctive, so that a concern might be something other than a complaint.
Really, it wouldn't. It would only be a complaint.
So this would only apply to a formal complaint that's given to the board.
I'm not sure, Mr. Chair, how you're thinking of the word formal. When we get a complaint, if it is within the board's jurisdiction, in other words, if we get a complaint that a veterinarian has not used appropriate surgical techniques, that would be a valid complaint and our investigator would open a case. If we get a complaint that a client didn't like the color of a veterinarian's tie, that's not jurisdictional and we wouldn't open a complaint. So there's really no distinction between formal and informal. It's either a valid complaint or it's not.
All right, Mr. Chair. Senator Atkinson.
So, in your bird analogy, somebody can call in a complaint without leaving their name, say that the clinic smells bad, and that's enough to have you guys come in and investigate?
No, Mr. Chair, Senator Atkinson, we do need some level of evidence. If we get a call that says the clinic smells bad, we're probably going to want more information, and we're not sure. I'm not sure actually whether a clinic that smells bad is. I mean, most veterinary clinics smell bad. The complaint would be something more specific along the lines of an observed non-compliant condition, such as heating or air conditioning that didn't work. Animal waste present and contributing to a bad smell, things that need to be disposed of properly not being disposed of properly, animal corpses visible, things like that.
Senator Byron.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What session did Senate Bill 318 pass?
0507.
It's the last session. Okay. And I guess, was there an issue or a problem that prompted either Senate Bill 318 or this bill? I mean, you already described it trying to, I guess, write the rules and implement 318. You found you didn't have this authority. But was there something that brought 318, I guess, forward that made you think you needed more authority than what you've had for the last 148 years or however long you've been around?
Yes, Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, we had a situation prior to our deadline for in 05, prior to our deadline for filing an agency concept. Situation arose in which a veterinarian who was boarding six horses allowed those horses to almost starve to death. It was in Yamhill County. I can't remember where it was. I think it was Yamhill County, Washington County. It hit the news. It was on. It's on, you know, internationally websites, animal abuse things. The board felt that a veterinarian who would allow horses to get to that condition might just not be a good practitioner. And what we discovered was we didn't have any authority to have this person go to get any kind of a physical or mental evaluation.
The person was a board licensed veterinarian, so obviously
yes.
He or she had passed a test. And
yes,
he was.
Yes, Mr. Chair, Senator Barr. The problem was that the way the statutes were prior to SB 318, the board can only look at the conduct of a veterinarian in the context of his or her veterinary practice, and this individual boarding horses was not considered veterinary medicine. That's why we wanted to have the authority in situations where the licensee's conduct is not being done in the context of veterinary medicine, but there is clearly cause for concern about that person's competency, to be able to direct them to go and be evaluated so that the board can be sure that they're not unfit to practice. Is that totally confusing?
Well, can I ask a follow-up?
Senator Pazanski.
Based on what Senator Barr is saying, you weren't taking action against the individual because of the way they were boarding the animals. It was because in his day job, was a licensed veterinarian, and there was a concern if he was allowing this to occur in this part of his life, maybe in his general practice, there could be other problems that would be questionable or actionable.
Mr. Chair, Senator Pazanski, that's exactly what the board was concerned about.
And that concern could arise not just from a complaint that's given by somebody in the public, but on the board's own motion. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, that's correct.
And I would guess, since you're asking for this additional authority now, that there are currently no administrative rules governing this that your board has adopted. Is that right? The ability to do the mental examinations under these types of circumstances.
Mr. Chair, Senate Bill 318 gave us the authority to discipline a licensee who refuses to undergo the exam. We don't have any rules that were filed after that. What we 134 kind of does what we should have done initially,
okay,
which was get the authority to direct them to have the exam.
Okay, very good. Is it Dr. Kolb?
No, Mr.
Mr. Kolb?
Thank you. Mr. Chair, committee members, my name is Glenn Kolb. I'm executive director with the Oregon Veterinary Medical Association. As Ms. McKinnon had mentioned, we did discuss this last weekend, and provided that the amendments are added to it where it's on evidence-based relative to inspection of facilities,
nice.
Well, we're good with this, and we would support the bill.
Okay, very good.
There's amendments to this thing.
There's not an amendment on the testimony.
Amendment.
Yeah, we're not going to move the bill today, so the proposed language is simply on the back of the sheet.
Okay.
And it appears that this, the stuff that's underlined, would be just added to what's in the printed bill.
I think so. All right, committee, anything further for today?
Well, I guess I have to ask one more question about
sure.
the 05 case. You said it wasn't because he was a bad vet. So was the person a bad? I mean, did the board have authority over the vet work? Obviously, I hope they did. And if they were doing a good job as a vet, isn't that what counts in a personal life?
Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, what happened in that case, and it was a she. She was a she. There were other issues going on as far as her conduct as a veterinarian. She had previously come to the board's attention because she closed down two clinics without notice, and then clients were not able to get their records. Nobody knew where she was, what was going on. So the horse issue was the thing that propelled the board to take a closer look at her overall competency to practice.
So by that, are you saying you then revoked her license?
No, we didn't have the authority to do that. What we ended up doing after there was a great deal of media attention and several board meetings, the board decided to offer a stipulated agreement under which she would cease to practice until her criminal trial was concluded. And luckily she agreed to that.
So you don't have the ability to discipline a vet because they're a bad vet, or you do have that ability?
I'm sorry, I'm misunderstanding your question, apparently, Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer. The board does have the ability to discipline a veterinarian if they act in violation of the Veterinary Practice Act. In other words, yes, if they're being a bad vet, the board can take disciplinary action against them. But in a case like this particular case, I don't think it's unreasonable to suspect that a person who allows animals to starve in her personal care might also not be a good practitioner in certain situations. And what the board wanted to do was simply find out whether that was the case, whether there was a mental problem that might have made her a bad vet as well as a bad caretaker of horses.
Hypothetically, if the situation had not been that it was horses being abused, but let's say Children's Services Division had come in and taken the children because the children were malnourished, is that the type of situation where maybe you could envision that it would be an indication there might be problems with the veterinary practice as well, giving you jurisdiction to do something?
Mr. Chair, I really don't. We haven't had that situation come up, but I think it would depend on the circumstances. We do have authority to discipline on the basis of a felony conviction or for a number of other things, such as moral turpitude. I don't know whether child neglect would fall into the things that we, and substance abuse also is something that we can discipline for without having to go through a lot of.
Sure, I'd add that I don't think what you're asking for is unlike what a lot of the boards and commissions that are really consumer protection commissions do in other areas. A board of medical examiners and the licensed family, the licensed counselors and psychologists. I mean, these people all have the ability, if they see something in a licensee that might indicate that there's a red flag, a problem with their practice, for consumer protection reasons, have the authority to step in. So, and I'm a little bit surprised you hadn't had that type of ability in the past, as much as you're seeking here.
Well, Mr. Chair, I think the problem is we thought we did.
Yeah. Okay. Committee, anything further today? Well, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 134. And absent anything else that the committee members have, we will adjourn for the day.